From Toronto, Canada, this is 1 MHz, the Apple II Podcast. In this episode, the summer camp for geeks gets ready to receive those campers. Vintage computer enthusiasts gather in Indiana, and while one emulator gets scriptable, another gets mobile. Also, a pair of news groups makes the news, you'll learn how to put your Apple programming skills to the test, and I review an adventure game, an arcade game, and a very unique Apple II-related book. It's all coming up on 1 MHz for July 2006. Welcome to 1 MHz, 8-bit Apple news and 2-bit Apple reviews. I'm Carrington Vanston. Thanks for listening. It's July, and that means this month is Kansas Fest, the Apple II-themed summer camp for geeks. As with last year, the event will take place at Rockhurst University in Kansas City, Missouri. It runs from Tuesday, July 18th to Sunday, the 23rd, and I, alas, will not be there. I've never attended Kansas Fest before. I've known about it for ages, and having recently gotten back into using and enjoying 8-bit Apples, I'm just dying to attend. I really wish I could go this year. If you are lucky enough to be attending, then I'm jealous. I'll be watching the Apple II websites and news groups for photos and recaps of the event, so if you're going, then have pity on those of us left behind and bring your camera. If you are going, the call is out now for participants to sign up to give presentations at the event. If you have a topic you'd like to present, you can sign up now and book a session time. I'll have a link to the online sign-up form in the show notes. Now, it's probably the case that if you're going, you know more about this than I do, but just in case, I thought I would mention it and link to the sign-up form. I am determined to go to Kansas Fest next year, so I'll be booking the time off as soon as the 2007 dates are announced. But this year, I will jealously watch from the sidelines. And speaking of cool events that I'll miss, I'm also not going to be attending the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest this time around. It's taking place on Saturday, July 15th, from 9:30 a.m. until 6 p.m. at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. That's just within reach of a weekend road trip from Toronto if I get a good tailwind, but unfortunately I'll be away that weekend. Presentations will include George Gobel and Mike Marsh giving a talk on the history of computing at Purdue, including the dual vax, and Jack Rubin will be giving a really interesting-sounding talk called Still an End User After All These Years, in which he looks back on over 50 years of personal computing. Admission is $5 US, with kids 17 and under admitted for free, and parking is free as well. And of course, the show notes for the podcast will include a link to the Vintage Computer Festival site, where you'll find a map and directions for the festival if you're lucky enough to attend. In other news, last month I talked about two popular emulators that had both been upgraded. And actually one of them was just upgraded again. Virtual 2 for OS X this month added Apple scripting and was bumped to version 5.3. But the really interesting news as far as emulators goes is the fact that there's a brand new emulator on the block. Well, I guess actually it's not just on the block, it goes around the block, because it's called Apple IIGo, and it's an Apple II emulator for MIDP 2.0 compatible mobile phones, such as the Nokia 6111. Apple IIGo's emulation speed isn't very fast yet, around a quarter of a megahertz or so, I think, but there's a coolness and a convenience factor that goes beyond just speed, so PlayStation Portable, eat your heart out, because now we can play Oregon Trail and Battle Chess on the bus. Well, I mean, I guess you could always do that, but it's much more convenient to do it this way than lugging an Apple IIe, a monitor, and a large gasoline generator onto public transportation. Bus drivers really don't have a sense of humor about those things. Trust me, I know. And let's see, what else? A pair of Apple II Usenet groups were in the news, so I guess the news made the news. This month, the Big 8 Management Board posted an RFD, a request for discussion, proposing the removal of the comp.binaries.apple2 group. The reasons for the proposal were cited as abuse, lack of moderation in the group, and the obsolescence of the Apple II platform. Now, guess which one of those three reasons I disagreed with. At first, I got my back up over it, but when I read the actual proposal, I agreed with it. The RFD just claimed that binaries for the Apple II platform were of interest now primarily to emulator users, and there are lots of websites from which such binaries can be obtained and to which they can be uploaded, and both of that is true. The issues of abuse also are pretty much unarguable. This was the only remaining Big 8 binaries group that was unmoderated, and it was sometimes being used as a flood zone for off-topic binaries. The RFD passed on the 15th, and the group will therefore be removed. Now, there's currently an open RFD for the removal of the comp.sources.apple2 group, along with a range of other comp.sources groups for other platforms like Mac and Sun and Amiga and a bunch of others. In these cases, the reason cited is primarily lack of use. There hasn't been a new post in the Apple II group, for instance, since 1987. Now, in case you're worried that this spells the end of the Apple II on Usenet, rest assured that there's still a thriving and active Usenet presence for our favorite 8-bit computer. The comp sys Apple II group and related hierarchy are alive and well. So, why not grab a newsreader if you don't already have one and join the discussion? Now, how are your coding skills? Rusty? Rust-free? Shiny and chromed? Well, the Apple Puget Sound Program Library Exchange, or APPLE, is ready to put them to the test with its 2006 Apple II Programming Contest. The contest is on now, and it runs until January 1st, 2007. Entries must be received by midnight on January 1st, and the winners will be announced on the 1st of February. There will be prizes for first through third place, as well as a prize for the most unique entry. The first place prize is $100 US in cash, a CFFA card, and a 2-year contract with APPLE for distributing the winning software. Very cool. Other prizes include other cash values, gift certificates, and the APPLE Complete Collection on DVD. I'll have a link to the contest announcement PDF in the show notes for this podcast on the Monsterfeet site so you can read the official rules and regulations. Now, according to the release, the purpose of the contest is to spur on new development of programs in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the Apple II coming up next year, which is a laudable goal, I'd say. I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of new software is generated as a result of the contest. Very exciting stuff. Now, also exciting is the object of my first review of this episode. It's a book called Micro Adventure. Well, actually, it's called Micro Adventure Number 1, Space Attack. It's written by Eileen Buchholz and Ruth Glick, and it was published by Parachute Press Book and Scholastic back in 1984. The back of the book says, "Your name is Orion, and you've received an urgent message from a distant space station. Something is wrong. Dead wrong. The space station is under attack. As the computer whiz on ACT, the Adventure Connection Team, only you can save it. You must use your micro to decode the alien messages, break into the enemy's security system, play a deadly game of laser attack. Space Attack is more than a great adventure story. It's danger, action, and suspense, plus computer programs for you to run." Yeah, this book is so cool. As you can tell, the story is that you are the member of an adventure team, and along with your compatriots, you have to go up to a space station and essentially stop it from being blown up. It's going to be blown up, you find, by a group called Brute, the Bureau of Random Unlawful Terror and Evil. So you and your group have to go up to the space station, and you are the computer whiz, and you help thwart the bad guys. And it is you. The book is written in the second person, so it's gender-free, which is very nice for young adult literature, which this is. And 8 or 9 times throughout the book, the character, the hero, has to use his computer programming skills to either decode a message or in some other way thwart the bad guys. So in the first chapter, for instance, you receive a coded message. And rather than just reading about how it gets decoded, you encounter a program listing. It's 10 or 11 lines. You have to type it in to your Apple II computer. You run it. Then you enter the coded message and the program decodes it so you can read the result. And then you go on to the next chapter. What's really nice about this is it's not just listing after listing of simple programs. You're introduced to a lot of basic but very interesting and important programming concepts. So while the early programs are ones where you're just given the listing, you type it in and you run it, very soon the hero character has to do some programming on the fly, and he does it very quickly. And in the book you read how he makes a mistake. There's a bug in the program. So not only do you have to type in the program, you have to track down the programming error and think about what the correction would be. Then you implement the correction and run the program, and then that gives you the correct result. It then progresses to the point where you're given just a snippet of a program, in fact, just the idea, and you have to use what you've learned from the earlier programs and write one completely from scratch. Now, the programs themselves are all very, very simple. There's no disk access or anything. It's really just manipulating strings, clearing the screen, and working with just basic mathematics. But it does introduce the beginning programmer to all of the basic concepts you'd need to know to get your head around the idea of writing software to solve a particular problem. The story itself is fairly pedestrian. The writing isn't great. It is young adult literature and only barely passable at that, I'd say. It also, unfortunately, has some errors in it, not just in the text of the story, but in some of the coded messages. So they really could have used a better editor, I think. But even with the occasional little error in the code and the occasional misprinting in the text, the story is fun, and it's very engaging to have to implement and write these programs and sometimes correct the programs along with the character as you read the book. I can't think of a more enjoyable way to introduce somebody, particularly a young person, to computer programming. This is a fantastic way to introduce someone to early concepts and techniques for software development. Now, it's a very short read. I spent, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half on it in total, including the typing and debugging time. But that was a very well-spent 90 minutes. You know, highly enjoyable. Now, as I said, the story itself is no great shakes, and the writing is pedestrian at best. It focuses on some ideas like missing toilet paper and a few things that I'm fairly certain the authors thought were jokes, but they were wrong. But it is nonetheless engaging and original and interesting. And if you or somebody you know would like to begin computer programming, or, you know, if like me, you just find it interesting to take a look back at the beginning of this sort of thing, then this is a unique and interesting read. I can't recommend it enough. Now, I'm assuming, because this is microadventure number 1, that there is a microadventure number 2, and maybe 3, etc. So I will try to track those down. And in the meantime, I will have the ISBN number for this book, and if I can find it, links to some online used bookshops that might still have this in stock. So you can check it out yourself. Microadventure number 1, Space Attack. I really like this thing. Now, that was the theme song to an adventure game called Escape, with an exclamation point. If you're like me, or if in fact you are me, then the micro-adventure book I just reviewed probably reminded you at least a little of the old choose-your-own-adventure books. They were published back in the 80s by Bantam, and along with Steve Jackson's Fighting Fantasy books, they helped me while away many hours reading them back then. Now, by reading, of course, I mean peeking ahead. I had a terrible habit of sneaking looks at the results of the choices and only committing to a path once I determined it wasn't a dead end. I'd often have multiple fingers in the book holding my place on various pages while I explored some option or another. I'm sure some people would call that cheating. I prefer to think that I was a pioneer in the field of parallel decision-making. Now, like the micro-adventure book, the choose-your-own-adventure books were also notable for being gender-free, as far as the hero goes, because they were written in the second person. Now, one difference is that the choose-your-own-adventure books were remarkably violent for children's literature, with missteps and incorrect decisions. They'd usually lead to endings where you're eaten alive by wild animals, or blasted by disintegration rays, or you freeze to death atop a snowy mountain. You know, good, cheerful kid stuff. Now, the form of the choose-your-own-adventure books seems to have originated with a fellow named Edward Packard in his book Sugarcane Island. He came up with the idea for an interactive story like this when trying to think of bedtime stories for his three kids. He called the stories The Adventures of You. So there was The Adventures of You on Sugarcane Island, followed by The Adventures of You in Deadwood City, and then The Adventures of You in the Third Planet from Altair. Bantam Books then picked up the interactive book idea and published his fourth book, The Cave of Time, as the first in its new series of Choose Your Own Adventure books. In fact, I remember reading The Cave of Time back eons ago. Packard went on to write more than 60 books in the Choose Your Own Adventure series. And now it turns out that in the 1980s, two of the Choose Your Own Adventure books were turned into computer games for the Apple II and the Commodore 64. And this month, I got my hands on one of those games. It's a game simply called Escape, with an exclamation point. Now, it's based on Choose Your Own Adventure book number 20 by R.A. Montgomery. Along with Packard, he was one of the most frequent authors of the Choose Your Own Adventure books, and he wrote dozens of them, one of which, of course, was called Escape. Now, I don't think I read Escape back then. At least the premise didn't seem familiar, and it goes like this. The year is 2045. The U.S. has split into three different countries. There's Dorado, which is in the southwest, and it dominates the others, and it's a police state. It has the slogan, totalitarian freedom forever. And it has a lot of firing squads. Now, another of the new countries is in the east, and it's called Rebellium. Yes, the rebels live in Rebellium. And then there's the country that you are from, as the hero of the tale, and it's in the north, and it's called Tertalia. In the game, as well as in the book, I assume, your goal is to escape from prison and make your way back to Tertalia with details of a planned invasion by Dorado. You're helped, sort of, by three other people in your party. There's Zooey, a resistance leader, Fred, who's a codebreaker, and Matt, who, well, you know, I never did figure out what Matt brings to the table. But you also know that one of those three is a traitor. Now, the gameplay is divided into three stages. First is, well, I guess it's a maze game. You walk out of jail, yeah, just walk out, no breakout, and then you try to find the invasion plans and then get out of the city. The game is kind of hard. Now, the mechanics of the game are easy. You rotate your party left or right or move forward and open doors with just a simple key press or a tap of the joystick. When you're faced with a decision, you're presented with a menu of 2 to 4 options. You just select an option by its number. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. But I meant the game is hard in the sense that it's very hard to stay alive. My first time through, I met my end after the first decision, 53 seconds into the game. Now, I know that because there's an on-screen timer ticking away in the bottom right corner. I guess you've only got so much time to smuggle the plans back to your own country. Now, the second time around, at the same first decision point, I again chose poorly and again was killed. This time, it took only 27 seconds before I was starting over. And yes, you have to start all over every time you die. There's no in-game save. So it's back to the virtual page one of this choose-your-own-adventure game every single time. See, the town is filled with policemen. They're always exactly the same. Only one of your four answers is correct and doesn't lead to death. And that's always the same answer, depending on where you are in the game. So after a couple of quick deaths, you solve the policeman puzzle. No problem. But the town is also filled with civilians, and they all look identical. But some of them give you things, and some of them mug you and kill you. And there's no way to know which is which before you talk to one. Now, after you talk to one, you find out if he's a mugger or a giver. And now you know because they don't move around. The same guy will be in the same location with the same motivations when you start over and over and over. Now, since the roads all have names and the layout of the town is static, it's possible to map your way through this stage, even if it's a bit annoying that the encounters are not really puzzles so much as, well, coin flips. I mean, it's like heads, you lose and start the game over. Tails, you move on and flip again. Now, the stage is kind of fun, but the real problem with this game is that it takes away the five big advantages you have when you read an actual choose-your-own-adventure book. And those five advantages, of course, are the fingers on your non-page-flipping hand. I mean, you're supposed to use those to hold your place while you peek ahead. I mean, come on! But in computer terms, we would call that a save game option, but you can't save your game in escape with an exclamation point. Instead, you face over and over what amounts to coin flipping. And okay, to be honest, I'm being a little, flippant here myself. It's not really as bad as I've made it sound, provided you don't play the game on an actual Apple II. I gave up using the real disc on my 2E and I grabbed a disc image to use with an emulator. The nice thing about most emulators is you can save the state of the virtual machine. Now that gives you, effectively, a save game feature. And with that, the gameplay changes dramatically. I mean, yes, the encounters are still uncontrollable. I mean, it's still just, hello, oh look, he gave me money, or hello, oh look, he stabbed me in the chest. And you only get to know which is which after you say hello. But still, if you'd rather have a simple adventure game that doesn't focus on puzzles, but instead emphasizes the mapping and the exploration aspect, then this stage can be a good and fun introduction to adventure games. So I would say that stage one would be a good first adventure game for somebody, provided you use an emulator and give yourself a save game option. Now, stages two and three are totally different. They are unplayable. Ugh. In both of these stages, you're driving a vehicle, a Jeep in stage 2 and an airplane in stage 3, but the gameplay is essentially the same in both. You move around, you are given completely nonsensical and contradicting advice from the rest of your party, and you randomly die. And unlike stage 1, you move at all angles, and there are no landmarks, so it's unmappable. You never know where you are, and you never know where you've been. You just move around at random, and I guess you hope you end up at the one location that means you win before ending up at any of the many locations that mean you die. It's ridiculous. These stages may as well have been a game called Blindfolded Minefield Walk. It's and your so-called teammates, they just spout a constant stream of contradictory advice. And even if you follow their advice, they don't. For instance, Zooey might say, oh, I recognize this place, we have to go east. So you move one step east, and then she'll say, oh, I recognize this place, we have to go west. So you move one step west, and you're right back where you started. But now she'll say, oh, I recognize this place, we have to go northwest. Zooey, you're ticking me off. The whole party is like that. It's so annoying. I want to kick him out of the Jeep. Well, actually, I want to kick him out of the airplane. Stages 2 and 3 are unmappable and unwinnable. They're unplayable and completely unenjoyable. They're four uns. Ignore them, they are dead to you. You play them at your peril. But even with all that said, Stage 1, on its own, using an emulator, is fun. It's a good first adventure game for somebody who doesn't want the puzzles, but does want to explore a maze and learn the basics of mapping and movement in an adventure game. So with that long list of caveats, I give the first third of the game thumbs up. Just ignore the rest of it. Now that is the sound of an arcade game from 1980 called Head On. I thought I'd look at something a little more action-oriented this month. It's hard to find information about this game. The splash screen says California Pacific Computer presents Head On from Tokyo, Japan. Now, California Pacific Computer was also the publisher of an early version of the game Ultima, I think. If I'm remembering my Ultima lore correctly, they picked up the game and published it in around 1980, and then later, I think the rights to Ultima were briefly in the hands of Sierra Online before finally going over to Origin, who published the Ultima version that I knew and played back then. But sticking with this head-on game, the disc label also has California Pacific Computers on it, note the plural, as well as a logo for Top of the Orchard Software, and it also says copyright 1980 ASTAR or A-Star International. So at least three companies seem to have had a hand in it. Online, I found one source that said someone named Lee Barnes was the programmer behind this game. So anyway, Head On is a simple arcade driving game. A top-down view shows a number of square racetracks set one inside the other and bisected by points where your car can jump from one track to another. Essentially, there are 20 different lanes for you to drive in, and the lanes are dotted with markers, Pac-Man style. Whenever you drive over a marker, it disappears and you receive points. If you get all the markers, you start over and everything's a little faster. The goal, like with a lot of early arcade games, is simply to try to set a high score. Now, there are two cars racing at the same time, one that you control and one controlled by the computer. The object is to drive over all the markers before your computer opponent crashes into you. Now, the other car can also help you, because sometimes when it drives over the markers, they grow in size and become worth more points. Now, the computer driver is a raving psychopath. He ignores all the dots and he focuses strictly on trying to smash into your car head on, thus the name Head On, which I assume is an abbreviation for something like, why would we license this guy to drive when he's a raving lunatic hell-bent on crashing into someone else head on? But that was probably too long to fit on the box. Anyway, the game itself seems to have originated as a coin-op arcade game, and it was sold by Gremlin and Sega in a lot of different cabinet types, including the traditional stand-up arcade cabinet. Sometimes it was bundled with another game. I remember here in Toronto that there was a head-on arcade game at a local drive-in years ago, and that one was bundled with, I think it was Space Attack on the same unit. I didn't play that one much, though, because at that same drive-in, they also had a Gorf machine, and, well, all hail the Supreme Gorfian Empire is all I have to say about that. The head-on coin-op game was billed as the first of Gremlin and Sega's multi-phase games, which meant it was the first one in which, as the player got better, the game got progressively harder. Now, this Apple II version of Head-On is a fairly faithful port of the arcade game, with one big exception that I'll get to in a minute. The graphics and sound are very much like the original, and well, you know, they're simple, they're perfectly fine for the game, and they never distract from the gameplay. The concept and gameplay are also very straightforward, and they're quite fun. But the programmer left out one very important feature of the coin-op version. See, like the coin-op game, you steer your car at the intersections, and you can slide over one or two tracks. The computer car can only slide over one track at a time, so you can use your extra reach to slip away from him. But in the coin-op game, you also have an accelerator button. When you press that, you zip ahead faster. And that's necessary in this game because often, due to the timing of the laps, you'll find yourself trapped in a lane and not able to make it to the intersection before the computer car gets there. And if he's close enough to your lane, or he's actually already in it, then you're going to crash if he beats you to the intersection. The accelerator lets you race ahead and avoid the collision if you time it right. It turns it into an arcade game. But the Apple II version doesn't seem to have an accelerator. I mean, not that I could find, and I pressed every key. And it's not mentioned in the instructions either, so I don't think I missed it. I think it's just not there. But without the accelerator, it's vastly harder to complete a level. I mean, in both the Apple II and the coin-op versions, once you've been on a level long enough, the computer car suddenly becomes much faster. That means you have to either finish the level or be close to finishing it before this happens, or you'll have almost no chance of avoiding a collision pretty soon. But with the accelerator gone, you just can't finish a level that quickly, which means the computer car always jumps to the faster speed, and shortly afterward, you will almost always crash into it. I mean, it's strange. It's almost like the programmer had seen images of the game and maybe read about it in brochures, but hadn't actually played it, because the accelerator is such a big part of the gameplay. Now, maybe you could memorize a pattern that would take you through a level perfectly so you could avoid crashing, and perhaps by doing that, that's the only way you can succeed at the game. I don't know, but if so, it kind of takes the arcade aspect out of the game a bit, and all you're left with is playing by rote. It's not as much fun. I mean, I did get to the second level a few times, maybe only once out of 20. So in the end, it's a moderately fun and fairly accurate arcade port with one big unfortunate caveat that sort of spoils the overall experience. I mean, I guess I'd give it barely a thumbs up, but that might be because I came straight from playing stages 2 and 3 of Escape with an exclamation point, which set the bar pretty low. I mean, I'll take a very difficult non-accelerator head-on game over a completely impossible, full of random death and frustration stage 3 of Escape any day. Which is just the sort of quote I bet the marketing department wished they put on the back of the box. So, to wrap up, this month I'd give a barely passing grade to Head On, though without the accelerator it doesn't offer nearly as much fun nor the extended gameplay of the arcade version. I would recommend checking out Stage 1 of Escape, the choose-your-own-adventure game, but only if you're looking for a game that downplays the puzzle aspect and focuses on mapping and exploration. And even then, only play it with an emulator so you can give yourself a save game option. It makes all the difference. But a big thumbs way, way down for Stages 2 and 3 of Escape with their nonsensical motion and coin flips of death. The big find this month, though, of course, is the book Micro Adventure Number 1. I can't recommend the book highly enough. Well, okay, the writing is maybe not the greatest, and it certainly could have used an editor. It is hard to think of a better and more enjoyable way to introduce somebody to the first stages of computer programming. Now, as always, I'll have disk images for the games I've discussed and also all the links from the podcast over in the show notes on the Monster Feet site. And I'll also have a look around to see if any of the big used booksellers list the Micro Adventure book in anybody's inventory. If so, I'll have a link so you can pick up a copy of the book yourself. And if not, then I guess I'll have a link to the query itself so you can search for it at another time. And I guess that brings me to the end of this month's podcast. I have a couple of very exciting games I'll be talking about next month. One is an Infocom text adventure. I'm not sure, though, which one I'll play yet. I've picked up a few boxes so far. I have Hollywood Hijinks, Ballyhoo, Moon Mist, The Lurking Horror, and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If you have a suggestion of which of those I should play before the others, then let me know. I'm also going to be ripping the shrink wrap off a brand new game for the Apple II next month. Now, I don't mean it's a recently published game. I mean it's a vintage, still-sealed, big-name game from the 80s, and I'm literally going to rip the shrink wrap off and play it. I can hear the screams of the collectors now, so tune in next month to hear which game I have decided to greatly devalue. Thanks for listening. I'll see you in August. You've been listening to 1 MHz, the Apple II podcast. Feedback and suggestions can be sent by email to feedback@monsterfeet.com. All the files and links mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes in the 1 MHz section of the monsterfeet.com website. And like all Monsterfeet podcasts, all the original material in this episode is released to the public domain.